Okay, so last time we just got started talking about black holes, and I drew some pictures and we explained some of the, you know, most important features of black holes, namely the fact that we have trapped surfaces inside a black hole, and we have that thing that we call the event horizon that marks the causal boundary of the black hole. That's the place from which you can no longer send signals to the outside. And I think the best illustration of the distinction between those two concepts is where you have gravitational collapse that gives you a black hole, but then, you know, at some point later, some mass, you know, falls inside the black hole. Maybe it acquires another black hole, or it acquires a star or something like this, or just mass falls in. And we can draw a distinction between the light ray that was focused to a stationary state by the, you know, first instance of gravitational collapse to the black hole. So we had the light ray that was expanding, but just got caught by gravity to an extent where it remains stationary, at least for some time. But then it gets focused by the additional matter that chooses to fall in at some later time. And those light rays that used to be stationary now become focused, and they actually fall into the singularity. So this light ray thought that it was the event horizon for some time, but then found out at some point that no, it wasn't. The event horizon was this light ray over here that was expanding for a very long time until it was caught up by the infalling matter and became focused by the infalling matter to then produce a stationary state. So that light ray over here that just started to expand in a normal way, thought that it was going all the way to infinity, but in fact, no, it was captured later in the process by the infalling matter, and then became stationary. And then if we can guarantee that no more matter will ever fall in, then that that light ray over here is in fact part of the event horizon. The point about event horizons is that we have to guarantee that things are controlled in the entire future before we can say anything. If we choose, a billion years from now to send even more matter inside the black hole, then that light ray that thought that, was the event horizon for a while will also get focused, will be trapped into the future singularity, into the singularity. And then it's going to be a preceding light ray that all along was the event horizon. In order to decide, we really have to control the entire future history of the space-time. So for that reason, the event horizon is a bit of an awkward thing. If you're, for example, in the business of doing numerical relativity and you want to collide black holes and you want to see where the inside of the black hole is so that you can excise it from your simulation so that it doesn't cause problems, well, you can't really rely on the event horizon, because for that you would have to terminate simulation after an infinite time and then trace backwards that finally stationary null surface that was the event horizon for the entire future, space-time. So because of that, the event horizon can be a little bit awkward, but if you're really looking for the causal boundary between the inside of the black hole and the outside, that place from which you can no longer send signals to the outside, well, that's the event horizon. And it's still a very important concept in black hole physics. So we've talked about trapped surfaces. If we're inside that region over here before the rest of the matter was about to fall in, the main observation about that point over here, which really in this diagram represents a two-dimensional surface, is that if you send a light ray outward from that surface, it will be caught in that gravitational field and it will immediately get converged into the singularity. So the outgoing light rays are converging, and that means that their rate of expansion is negative. So that's really the characterization of the trapped surface, is the fact that for the outgoing normal to that surface, the expansion is negative. That doesn't happen if you're safely outside. It does happen if you're inside. And the notion of a trap surface is something that, in fact, can be used locally to determine whether you're inside or outside the black hole. Because if you're inside a trapped region where, the two surfaces inside that region are all trapped, then, you can be pretty sure that you're inside the black hole, even if you're not sure of where the black hole, the boundary actually is. Now, it can be deceptive because if you find a trapped surface, you know you're inside the black hole. But here, for example, we have an outgoing direction that is expanding. So that surface over here is not trapped. But the fact that it's not trapped doesn't guarantee that it's inside, outside the black hole, because, you know, as soon as the enfalling matter goes in, that light ray will become trapped. And inside here, we have trapped regions. So, finding a trapped surface is pretty much a guarantee that you're inside the black hole. Not finding one is not a guarantee that you're outside the black hole, because something can happen that will turn that trapped surface, you know, that untrapped surface into a trapped surface if matter happens to fall in. But anyway, so the ability to locate a trapped surface and to find the boundary of the trapped region is something that also plays a very important role in black hole physics. And we're going to, talk about this. So we know all about how to calculate expansions for outgoing light rays. So we're going to apply this to a more quantitative version of that cartoon, just so that we understand where to find these things. Okay, so what I could draw here is the boundary of the trapped region. So all the surfaces inside that would-be event horizon here are all trapped. Well, they're not trapped here. So the boundary of the trapped region starts somewhere like here. And then all the two surfaces in the future of that, to the left, to the future of this line and to the left of that line are all trapped surfaces. So that's the boundary of the trapped region. But then the boundary of the trapped region, because of the enfalling matter, will jump from this location here to that location there. So here we thought we were safe, but no, the enfalling matter means that the untrapped region here will be turned into a trapped region. So the boundary is something that will naturally go from the inside to the outside to catch up with that, that would be event horizon, if we can guarantee that nothing will ever happen in the future. So that over here is the boundary of the trapped region. Also known as the apparent horizon. So those are words that we'll be using and words that are being used in the literature. So it starts here and then traces that, then jumps out, traces that for a while, and then who knows what's going to happen beyond that. Yep?
Does the horizon stay in the alternate
Sorry?
Like, does the trap horizon press the apparent horizon? Does that stay null as the...
No, so that's a key thing that we'll explore today. It's null when nothing happens, but when you acquire mass, the boundary becomes space-like. So we have a space-like segment that joins those two null segments, and that means that because of that space-like segment here, it pretty much guarantees that the boundary of the trapped region has to be inside the event horizon, because the event horizon is a null hypersurface at all times. Anyway, so we'll keep exploring this, and we'll do some calculations to back this up. But in the end, I think the calculations don't add very much to that picture. I think the picture tells us everything. So I really like those cartoons, because they really tell us everything that's going on. And the rest is just, a little bit of quantitative detail that can be important sometimes. But, in the end, perhaps doesn't add that much to the story. But anyway. We'll do that. Okay, other questions before we move on? So that's pretty much where we were last week. All good? Okay, so we're going to start with the simplest situation. We're going to start with the simplest description of a black hole, and that's provided by the Schwarzschild metric. And then what I want to do in the Schwarzschild metric is to find ways to, you know, to find out where the trap surfaces are. We're going to locate the outgoing geodesics. We're going to, you know, calculate the expansion for those. And we're going to try to see where the expansion changes sign. And of course, we won't be surprised that if we're dealing with the Schwarzschild metric, where there's no infalling matter, then the boundary of the trap region will be R equals 2m, which will coincide with the event horizon. So no big surprise, but it's nice to be able to do the calculation. All right, so let's talk about a Schwarzschild black hole. And I'll just say space-time just to make a point, but then we'll specialize this to a black hole. And of course, we know what the solution is. It's a solution to the Einstein field equations in vacuum. It is spherically symmetric and static. And there's a couple of important theorems about this metric that is worth quoting. So first, there's something called the Birkhoff theorem. And that's the statement that the Schwarzschild metric is the metric outside, in the vacuum region, outside any spherically symmetric object, whether the object itself is static or not. So that's the statement of the theorem. So the Schwarzschild metric is the outside metric of any spherically symmetric body. And here, the key aspect of this is that we're assuming spherical symmetry. We're not assuming that the body is static. So the body could be pulsating, the body could be collapsing, the body could be expanding. And the metric inside might be time dependent. But the metric outside the body, because of spherical symmetry and because there are no ways of emitting spherical gravitational waves, the metric outside is necessarily static. And it's going to be described by the Schwarzschild metric. So the Schwarzschild metric describes the space-time outside any spherically symmetric body, including a black hole, but also including anything that's not a black hole. Did I say a question? Yeah?
Yeah, it uses Einstein equations of motion, like words.
So that statement is, well, there are extensions of this in other theories of gravity because spherically symmetric space-times are very constraining. But you could have, for example, a scalar tensor theory of gravity where you could have spherical waves emitted in the scalar sector, and the theorem would not hold there. Right. So here we're limiting ourselves to Einstein's theory.
But as long as you have
an example is which? Sorry. I didn't hear what kind of gravity. That could well be. I'm not too sure, but I'll take your word for that. Yeah, lots of examples where the theorem would not hold, but if we're talking about Einstein, then that's a true statement. And then there's another theorem that's equally famous, and that's Israel's uniqueness theorem. And that's the statement that if we are talking a black hole, and if we are talking about a black hole that is static, and a black hole that's asymptotically flat, then the metric of that black hole must be the Schwarzschild solution. So the Schwarzschild metric is the unique solution to the Einstein field equation in vacuum. For a static black hole that's, so I'm not saying this in the most elegant way, but for, let me say it like this, for a static and asymptotically flat with a non-singular event horizon. So the statement here is that if we have an event horizon, therefore if we have a black hole, and if the space-time is static, and if it's asymptotically flat, so it's basically vacuum everywhere all the way to infinity, if we have all of those conditions, then according to Einstein's theory, the solution that describes this object must be the Schwarzschild metric. And the key point is that here we're not assuming spherical symmetry. Spherical symmetry comes out as a consequence of the uniqueness theorem, not as an assumption. So spherical symmetry is a consequence, not an assumption of the theorem. If we were to make this an assumption, of course, the theorem would tell us very little, but the fact that we don't put that in but get it out is what makes the theorem pretty unique. So the statement here is that you could start with a cube, you collapse it, collapse it down to a black hole, and anything that was telling us in the structure of the gravitational field that we were previously dealing with a cube, all of that information, namely the multiple moments of the cube, go away in the process of gravitational collapse, and what ends up being produced is a perfectly spherical black hole. Now, real stars don't tend to be cubical, so it's a bit of a artificial image, but nevertheless, we can apply this to real stars, because real stars will always have all sorts of little bumps on them. They will never be completely spherically symmetric. Nevertheless, if they collapse in a static, and give rise to a static spacetime, here we're ruling out rotation. So we'll talk about the Kerr black hole and the uniqueness property of the Kerr solution a little bit later. But if there's no rotation in the gravitational collapse, then a star of arbitrary shape will necessarily produce a spherically symmetric black hole. So that, is not something that was expected. People in the early days of black hole physics expected black holes to be as bumpy as stars can be. But the uniqueness theorem rules this out. The uniqueness theorem says that the gravitational field cleans itself out in the process of gravitational collapse. And, while you might have expected the Schwarzschild metric to be a simplified and idealized description of a black hole, it in fact applies to all, non-rotating black holes. So it's a pretty remarkable thing. Remarkable also in the fact that, this is so simple. So, and even the Kerr metric, more complicated, but the Kerr metric is also a very simple metric, and that describes all rotating black holes beyond the situation here where you allow for rotation. So that's a really remarkable theorem, and it really simplifies our life of describing what's going on in black holes. So for a while, I'm going to stick with Schwarzschild. And probably in the afternoon, I'll move on to Kerr, but I want to do what I can with Schwarzschild and some generalization thereof to continue to explore this idea of trapped surfaces and converging light rays and all of that. Yep.
But the fact that we have expanded universe doesn't add much, right?
So yeah, so if you want to include aspects of the large scale structure of space-time, including the expanding universe, then you have to examine the premises a little bit. So it's not true that you're going to be strictly in vacuum. You're going to be immersed in a cosmological background. But typically what happens there is that, you have very, very disparate, different scales. You have the cosmological scale where you have to assume the presence of matter. And then you have the scale of black holes, which are much shorter, kilometers versus Hubble radii. And so long as you maintain that separation of scales, you don't really need to revisit anything, in your part of the universe. You're basically in an asymptotically flat situation. It's just that when you go really to cosmological scales that you realize that asymptotic flatness is not a true property of your space-time, but that doesn't spoil anything else. But it does say that, as usual, theorems are mathematical constructions with simplifying assumptions built in. As you start relaxing those, you introduce complications that typically will not violate anything, will not kill the true statement of the theorem, but will make the proofs a lot harder to to achieve.
And this non-singular, sorry, non-singular event horizon, this is also a generic thing, right? Like how restrictive is that assumption?
Oh, the non-singular event horizon? Yeah, well, if you want to talk about black holes, you have to talk about an event horizon that's not a singular place in space-time. And that's pretty essential. Otherwise, it would be a naked singularity or something, analogous to that. So it's phrased like this because that's how the theorem is proved, and it's proved essentially by contradiction. So if you don't have the Schwarzschild metric, you would develop a singularity on the event horizon. But yeah, if we're talking about black holes, we are implicitly assuming that we're dealing with the event horizon as a regular embedded null surface in space-time. Did you have a question?
Oh, yeah. Zverkov, the only assumption is isospectral symmetry, right?
And spherical symmetry. So we're saying we're looking at spherically symmetric metrics, yeah, inside and outside a body. Okay, so let's do a few things in Schwarzschild. So we want to take the Schwarzschild metric and do something both inside and outside the event horizon. And of course, the first thing that we encounter when we choose to do that is that, well, the Schwarzschild coordinates are singular on the event horizon. So that's the usual story, that if you throw in an observer and that observer crosses the event horizon, that will occur in infinite coordinate time, but finite proper time, and that means that the coordinate t that we're using to describe the Schwarzschild metric, even though it was fine when we were, doing physics far away from the black hole, it becomes ill-suited to the description of the space-time near the black hole. So the first thing we need to do if we want to handle transition from the outside to the inside of the event horizon is to deal with that coordinate singularity. And here I'm going to make my usual assumptions that you've seen all of this before and you know about how to construct coordinate systems. And I'm not going to assume strongly that you know all about cross-cul coordinates because I'm not going to use them in this course, but hopefully you've heard of this. If you haven't, maybe my diagrams that I'm about to draw are going to be a little bit obscure, but don't worry, I'm not going to use cross-cul coordinates because I have a better option in terms of a regular coordinate system that solves this coordinate problem of the original form of the Schwarzschild metric. So, but let's talk a little bit about cross-cul coordinates, because while they can be useful, and I find them mostly useful in the context of drawing pictures, I don't find them very very convenient to do calculations for a reason I'll, describe in a minute. But, in terms of drawing pictures, they're pretty convenient. So basically, I'll just say that cross-cul coordinates is a way of getting away from that coordinate singularity that that comes with the original form of the metric. And when we look at the Schwarzschild metric in cross-cul coordinates, we realize that, well, there's a much larger space-time that's at our disposal compared to what we thought was there to begin with. And that's the purpose of the cross-cul diagram, to reveal that. So I'll just describe this basically in cartoon again. So that's the cross-cul diagram that has two copies of the horizon, r equals 2m, has an outgoing branch and an ingoing branch. It has two copies of the singularity, one in the future, one in the past. And it has two copies of every r equal constant surface that you can find in a space-time. Those would be the r equal constant surfaces outside the black hole. Those would be r equal constant surfaces inside the black hole. And we have two copies of everything. So it's a bit strange. And not only is it strange, it's a little bit extravagant, because if we're going to do anything with black holes, we typically don't need that much of a space-time. And if we're remembering that the black hole was formed in the first place by gravitational collapse, then there's a lot of this that's not even part of the actual space-time. So I'll just say a few things about this. The one thing that makes the cross-cul coordinates really useful is that in those coordinates, light rays propagate at 45 degrees. So we have incoming light rays always going in that direction at 45 degrees, and outgoing light rays going this way also at 45 degrees. So the one thing that the cross-cold coordinates do really well for us is to establish all the causal relationships between various events in space-time. So what do we have? So we have r equals zero here, that's the black hole singularity. We have r equals zero here, that's the white hole singularity. We have r equals 2m here, that's the black hole horizon. We have r equals 2m here, that's the white hole horizon. And this is an r equal constant surface. And this is another copy of that r equal constant surface. And we have more r equal constant surfaces inside the black hole, inside the white hole. And then I'm not going to draw them, but the t equal constant surfaces would be straight lines that come straight out of that bifurcation point here. So we would have straight lines coming off like this. Those would be t equal constant surfaces, you know, in the original coordinate system. So that's the black hole region. That would be, you know, one of the outside region. We have another one over here. And that would be the white hole region that comes with a past singularity. And what's a white hole? Well, it's basically just the mirror image or the time reversal of a black hole. So, you know, once you're inside the black hole, you can't get out. Once you're inside the white hole, you cannot, you know, but escape. There's no way you can remain inside. And if you're thinking of how things would move here, if they have to stay within the 45 degree cone, then, you know, that's an observer that can choose to stay forever outside, or that's an observer that can choose to go in. But once the observer is in, there's no way out because the light cone is always restricted to 45 degrees. So once in, there's no escape to the singularity. If you're in the white hole region, well, here you have no choice. You have to go out. Now, so the reason why the cross-cold coordinates and the cross-cold diagram is useful, because, you know, we can map out the entire space-time like this and have this clear causal link that comes from the light cones being at 45 degrees. So that is very much a convenient aspect of this. The fact that it has so much in it, and that so little of that is actually relevant to the actual space-time, well, that's, you know, that's an inconvenience. And another inconvenience is the fact that in terms of the cross-cold coordinates, r, you know, our good old Schwarzschild r is no longer a coordinate. It's defined implicitly in terms of the actual coordinates, cross-cold coordinates. And because the, you know, you can't even write the function r is equal to this, it's something that you have to solve through a transcendental equation. So it's only defined implicitly. And in computations, well, that's awkward because, you know, for a given set of cross-cold coordinates, you know, it's not easy to figure out to which r this corresponds. So, you know, they're a bit cumbersome to work with. And fortunately, there are alternatives. And I just wanted to motivate my choice of alternative compared to this. Now, the reason why so little of this is actually relevant to an actual black hole produced by gravitational collapse is the fact that, well, the Schwarzschild solution describes only the outside of the collapsing star. And everything that pertains to the inside is not described by the Schwarzschild metric. So the cross-cold diagram must be restricted to what goes on outside only. And if we do that, well, we can redraw this picture, but now I'm going to draw it in dashed terms because, you know, in dashed lines, because so little of it is actually going to be realized. So we would have, you know, the future singularity here, the past singularity here. What we have to put in the space-time diagram that would give us the boundary of the Schwarzschild solution, where it really applies, is the collapsing star. And the collapsing star, well, the collapsing star would be created at constant radius. And then, so it would follow one of those hyperbolas here. But eventually, it would start collapsing, and it would collapse down to the event horizon and beyond. So what we have to put in here as a boundary is the surface of the collapsing star that would behave something like this. Constant radius, then radius starts to decrease. crosses the event horizon, and then eventually meets the singularity. And the point is that the Schwarzschild solution applies only to the outside, so only the outside part of this diagram is relevant to the spacetime. So we can draw everything to the right of this in solid lines, because that really is created by the collapsing star. It really is the Schwarzschild exterior. But everything else inside is never realized, because the metric inside is not Schwarzschild. It's whatever metric is describing the collapsing star. So all of the stuff here corresponding to the inside of the star has nothing to do with the Kruskal diagram. And because of that, while this branch here of r equals 2m never exists, that branch here of r equals 0 doesn't exist. So all of the stuff that was very extravagant from before, including the other asymptotic region outside the white hole and black hole, well, none of that is actually realized in the physical spacetime, because we have to switch from the Schwarzschild metric outside to the relevant metric inside. So because of that, the Kruskal diagram is really, still useful for certain purposes, but, it covers way too much, and a lot of it is not actually relevant. So because of that, I prefer to use different coordinates where we are not constantly reminded of those extra regions that don't actually exist. Now, in theoretical physics, we can play around with the idea that the black hole existed forever. And if we buy that idea, then the space-time diagram would apply at all times and everywhere in space-time. But, that's very much a figment of the theorist's imagination. If we think more accurately that black holes are created by gravitational collapse, then it's only a very small portion of the Kruskal diagram that gets realized. Okay. So, again, if you don't know anything about Kruskal coordinates, don't worry. I'll draw those pictures from time to time, but I'll do calculations using something else entirely. Okay, so let's talk about a simpler and much more user-friendly system of coordinates that allows us to go across the event horizon, and that's what I called the Eglinton-Finkelstein coordinates. And like a lot of coordinate systems that turn out to be useful, those are going to be based on light rays. And we've talked a lot about light rays already, so I'm going to recap some of this, but go pretty quickly. So I'm going to factorize the Schwarzschild metric in the way that I've done before. We're going to have a dt minus f to the minus 1 dr that will multiply dt plus f to the minus 1 dr. And then I'm going to leave the angular part of the metric all alone. There's nothing wrong with the theta phi coordinates. And the factorization tells us that those are null directions. So this I would relate that to a coordinate u, or to a quantity u that happens to be constant on ingoing light rays. And here we would have a v that would be constant on outgoing light rays, as we've described before. And what I'm going to do here is to make a choice between u and v as a replacement for t. I don't want to lose r. R is very useful as a coordinate, especially because, it is involved in the metric like this explicitly. So it would be a high cost to lose r as a coordinate, so I don't want to pay that. I'm going to keep r as a coordinate. I want to kill the problem associated with t, and that I can do either by adopting u as a new coordinate or v as a new coordinate. And then it's just a matter of choice of where in the space-time I want to work. And the claim is that if I want to work around here, then I better use v as a coordinate, not u. And I'll explain why in just a second. So u would be defined as t minus the integral of 1 over f. V would be defined as t plus the same integral. That would be constant on outgoing light rays. And that's constant on ingoing light rays. So let's draw a picture and decide why V is a better idea here. And I'm going to use the Kruskal diagram to illustrate this. Here's our Kruskal diagram, and then we have two families of light rays. The outgoing ones go out like this. So they originate at the path singularity, and then they go out and they go all the way to infinity. And we have the ingoing ones that originate at infinity and go in. So they behave like this. So I think the diagram at least will suggest that if we were to use U, so those are U equal constant rays, those are V equal constant rays. If we're using U, chances are that we're going to have a good description of the past horizon, because the outgoing light rays cross this horizon, you know, without, you know, noticing anything. So if we were to use U as a replacement for T, we would get a metric that would be very well suited to describe the past horizon of the Schwarzschild spacetime. And they wouldn't be any good over here, because as we keep looking at more and more of those rays, we would find that they all pile up over here. And, you know, they would never allow us to go beyond R equals 2m. So for that reason, U would not work here. It would still produce a singular metric here, but it would be perfectly fine there. It's just that we're not interested in the past horizon, because it's not even part of the spacetime. We're interested in the future horizon. So if we want to, you know, have success here, we better use the incoming light rays that that cross the future horizon without noticing anything peculiar. So we're going to use those coordinates because we have a perfectly fine description over here. We have an accumulation down here in the same way that we had in the other case, but this accumulation here doesn't matter one bit because, again, the past horizon is not even part of what we think of the spacetime. So using V as a coordinate system will allow us to handle the problems at R equals 2m at very low cost, because we're not using R, we keep using R as a coordinate, which simplifies calculations, and we have a coordinate system that doesn't do the job everywhere in a Kruskal diagram, but does a perfect fine job where it matters. So we're going to be using V as a replacement for T, and then it's just a matter of making the replacement in the metric, and then seeing what the metric looks like in those coordinates, and then we can be confident that the metric will be perfectly fine across the horizon, and that will be, you know, setting up the way to do calculations that allow us to go from the outside in and, you know, calculate things like the expansion in a way that's going to be, you know, sensible. All right, so let's just do that. So I'm going to replace, so I'm going to go back to the original form of the metric, and I'm just going to replace dt by what it stands for now in terms of dv. So that's what we choose to do here. We're going to re-express dt as dv minus f minus 1 dr. And I'm going to plug that inside the metric and see what this gives us. So let's work it out. So I'm going back to the expression up there. So we have minus f multiplying dt squared, but now I'm rewriting this as dv minus f minus 1 dr all squared. And we have f minus 1 dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. So I'm just going to work this all out. We have dv squared minus 2 f minus 1 dv dr plus f minus 2 dr squared plus f minus 1 dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. And now we see some interesting cancellation. The dr squared term over here comes with a minus F in front. So we have minus F to the minus 1. Here we have a plus. So those two terms cancel out. And what survives in the end, that's going to be our new expression for the metric, is minus F dV squared plus 2 dV dr plus R squared d omega squared. And this, I claim, is a form of the Schwarzschild metric expressed in good coordinates that allow us to easily go from outside the black hole to the inside of the black hole, working around that region over there. If you're worried about the fact that we still have something that goes to zero when r equals to 2m in the metric, don't worry, it doesn't create any harm. So the real problem over there was the f minus 1 dr squared in the metric that we've lost now. The f dv squared over here is not a coordinate singularity because, you know, our coordinates are attached to light rays that don't see anything peculiar going on as they enter the event horizon. So it's always a good idea to look for coordinate systems that are attached to either light rays or infalling observers or things like that. You know, if the coordinates have meaning in terms of observer measurements, then you can be confident that if those observers don't see anything strange, then the coordinates will not be strange themselves. And that's an example of this where I'm using light rays instead of time-like observers. That would be another option. And you can do all sorts of things like that. Okay, any questions at this point? No. Okay, so that's all good. All right, so here's what we're trying to do. So I'm trying to basically flesh out mathematically what we've learned about in this cartoon. And I want to show that the expansion of outgoing light rays goes from positive to negative as we go from outside to inside the black hole. So I just want to flesh the cartoon out with mathematical detail. So what we're going to be interested in doing now is to not look at the incoming light rays anymore. We've dealt with those. V is equal to a constant on those. We're going to be looking at the outgoing light rays, and we're going to see what changes in them as we go from outside to the inside. And we're going to calculate the expansion, the rate of expansion parameter, and we're going to see that, sure enough, if the light rays are outside, they're expanding. If they're inside, they're converging. The picture makes this completely obvious, but we're going to see how that comes about mathematically. Okay, so we're going to look at outgoing light rays. I'm going to use the V and R coordinate system. But I'm going to be selecting those, the other light rays, the ones that propagate with U equal constant. So we're going to say that that du is going to be 0. But now I'm going to be re-expressing du, not in terms of dt and dr, but in terms of dv and dr. So du was equal to, as we defined it, dt minus f minus 1 dr. But now I want to make the substitution I made before. That's going to be dv minus 2 1 over f dr. So that's the description of outgoing light rays. And the statement is that, u is going to be equal to a constant, and u is going to be v minus twice the integral of 1 over f dr when reinterpreted in terms of the new coordinates. All right, so that's the starting point. So we're saying that u is equal to a constant. And we're defining a null surface by the statement that u is equal to a constant. And that gives us a normal vector to the hypersurface. And what we could define this null vector to be, and I'm going to put a bar on the letter because eventually I'm going to change to another null vector that's going to be a rescale version of this one for a reason I'll describe in a moment. And I can define this to be the gradient of my U quantity. And that means that it's going to be in components, you know, in components VR theta phi, it's going to be a vector that has component minus 1 in the V direction and minus 2 over F in the R direction and 0 and 0 in the angular directions. So that's my, sorry, I forgot the overall minus 1, so that should be a plus. So to make my k vector point toward the future, I'm taking it to be minus the gradient of u, and then minus minus gives me a plus. Okay, so that's my null vector in the new coordinate system. That's so that's a vector that's going to be normal to our outgoing light cones. And then if I raise the index on this, I'm going to get the vector that's tangent to the null rays, the outgoing null rays. So I can raise the index on this one. And all I have to do that is to take my metric and invert it. And then we can work out the, you know, the action of raising the index on the k vector. I'm going to skip a few steps, but you can find them in the posted notes. And if we calculate that vector, it's a vector that's going to be in the v component, it's going to be 2 over f. In the radial component, it's going to be 1 and 0, 0. So that's the null vector. So that's normal to the u equal constant surface. That's normal to the outgoing null rays. So we've done things like this before, so no surprise here. And if we work out a few more details, well, what we're going to find is that because my my covector here is defined to be a straight gradient, that will satisfy, you know, the vector will satisfy the Judy's equation in affine parameter form. So we have two statements about k. First is that it's a null vector. And we have the statement that it satisfies the Judy's equation in the usual form. So the parameterization of my null generators in this case, or the my null rays, is an affine parameterization. All right. Well, what is the description of the null rays? The description of the null rays is that dv d lambda, whatever the parameter is, that's going to be the v component of my vector, and it's going to be 2 over f. And dr d lambda, that's going to be the r component of my vector, that's 1. And that tells us that the affine parameterizing, the affine parameter on the null geodesics is in fact r itself. And that sounds like a great thing, because R is a very meaningful quantity, but we're going to see that it would lead us to very strong problems if we were to keep working with that vector in that parameterization. And I'll just tell you why in a second. So it sounds like an ideal choice of parameter, but in fact it's not. And we're going to see why in a second. And then of course, the description of the angular motion would be that they move, the null geodesics move with constant values of phi and theta. Okay, so why am I not happy with this? Well, I'm going to draw some cartoons again. Here's the reason. So I'm going to draw the Kruskal diagram again. Right. So we're talking about outgoing light rays. And my outgoing light rays, well, if I'm on this side of the event horizon, they originate at the past singularity, and then they go out to infinity like this. And R would be an increasing parameter on those light rays. So that's all fine. But I really want to look at what happens to those outgoing light rays as I go from the outside to the inside of the event horizon. And if I'm on the inside of the event horizon, well, that's the outgoing light ray. And it so happens that this outgoing light ray originates from infinity, falls toward the singularity, and the parameter that runs along that light ray is a decreasing R. So here R is increasing along the outgoing light ray, but here R is decreasing. And nothing wrong with that. I mean, R is still a perfectly good parameterization here and a perfectly good parameterization there. It's just that it runs in opposite directions, increasing here, decreasing there. The problem is if you're, you know, if you really want to see what happens as you take, you know, as the, you know, in a transition from the outside in. So if I'm looking at the light ray, the outgoing light ray that hugs the event horizon like this, the problem I'm having here is that here R is a constant. It's equal to 2m. So what used to be a very good parameterization outside and a very good parameterization inside gives me a completely useless parameterization at the transition point right on the event horizon, because R is constant, and therefore that's a place where the parameterization breaks down in a rather spectacular way. So that's the problem. If I want to really describe what happens to the outgoing light rays as we go from the outside to the inside, I have to change my parameterization, because if I don't, I'll end up in the limit with a parameterization that completely breaks down right on the event horizon. And there's no continuous way of actually seeing what happens to the outgoing light rays as we go in a sequence that would take us from the outside to the inside. Fine. R seemed to be a very nice choice of parameterization. It turns out it's not, so let's do something else. So we're going to switch our parameterization, and the price to pay is that what used to be an affine parameterization will become non-affine, so the statement of the geodesic equation will be slightly more complicated, but otherwise the description of what happens as we take that sequence will be elucidated. So we'll have much more success with that new parameterization. And, if I have to give up R, and I can't use theta and phi because they're constant, well, you know, maybe the next best choice is to use my other coordinate, the remaining one, namely V. And V is something that will, you know, increase. You know, remember that V is equal to a constant along each one of these ingoing light rays, so V increases as we go out like this, and V will provide for us a very nice parameterization of my outgoing light rays. As we follow the light rays, we'll see that we're going to see that V increases along those light rays, and we might as well use that as a parameter. And the only thing is that it's going to be non-affine, as I said just before. So how do we achieve this? Well, we just rescale the vector. We're going to get rid of this factor of 2 over f. We're going to put it in front. And we're going to rescale the entire vector by that factor. And we're going to make the new vector, you know, having a 1 entry here. So what we're going to do is to introduce a new parameterization. And we're going to pick v to be the parameter. And the way that we're going to do this is to say that we're going to take our old vector, and we're going to get rid of the factor of 2 over f. That was the problematic factor. We're going to get rid of that factor, and we're going to define a new vector, a new null vector k, so without the bar on top. And that's going to be just a rescaled version of the old one, so it's not going to spoil the fact that it will be a null vector. But it will change the nature of the geodesic equation, as I keep saying. So what is that null vector? So that null vector is, you know, the v entry of that null vector is going to be 1, because I kill the, I factorize the 2 over f. And then the R entry is going to be half F, and we're still going to have zeros in the angular entries. So that's going to be our new vector. That's going to be the new version of the null vector we're going to pick. And because I have an entry of 1 here, that means that dvd lambda now is equal to 1. And that means that lambda, that the parameter lambda is now, you know, equated with v. So we're switching to a v parameterization. Okay. Yes, please. We're just changing the parameterization. That's really all this is. Right? So we have parametrized curves. Our null geodesics are parametrized curves, and we can parameterize those curves in ways that we can choose, and I'm choosing a different way with respect to what we had before. That's the only meaning there is. Okay, so let's see. So I want to calculate a couple of things with this. So that factor over here I will call mu, just to save notation a little bit. And I'm therefore defining mu to be half, so 2 over f. And 2 over f, that was dvd lambda previously, so it's actually dvdr. So I'm going to write it like that. 2 over f is dvdr, and that's something that I'm going to use in later calculations. And so we've rescaled. I've defined my mu wrong. So what I wanted to do is to invert this relation over here. I'm going to say that k, my new vector, is going to be a rescale version of the old one I used to work with. And then mu is going to be the inverse factor, so it's going to be half f. And half f is dr dv. So that's how I want to write this. Okay, good. So I'm going to write it like that. And the reason why I'm doing this is because I want to relate things that, so I want to relate how the two vectors behave. In particular, I want to just look again at the geodesic equation, but now formulate it in terms of the new vector. And then I want to look at the expansion of my outgoing light rays. And we're going to calculate the expansion in that non-affine parameterization that we just gave ourselves. And that is something that we have some experience with because we were talking about that last week. But I'm going to, you know, rework all of this just as a sort of consistency check. Okay, so let's see. So get this up. Okay, so I'm going to do two things now. So now I have the new description of the outgoing light rays in the new parameterization. And I want to check the new form of the geodesic equation with a non-zero right-hand side. And then I'm going to calculate the expansion of the outgoing light rays. And finally, I will verify that the expansion is positive on the outside, negative on the inside. And on the horizon, of course, it's going to go to zero. All right, so let's check the geodesic equation. And all I have to do is to calculate this over here. And I'm just going to rely on the fact that I know that in terms of the original k hat vector, k bar vector, I had the usual form of the geodesic equation. So all I have to do is to basically relate the two. So that k beta here, I'll write it as k bar beta. And then we have a derivative of mu times k hat, sorry, k bar alpha. And I can just, you know, work this all out. So first I'll leave this alone, differentiate that. So I'm going to get a new squared, and then I'll have k bar beta differentiating, so k bar alpha being differentiated in the direction of k bar beta. And that's, of course, going to be 0. And then I'm going to have mu times the derivative of mu. So that's going to be k bar gradient of mu. And all of this will be multiplying k bar alpha. So so the right-hand side is not going to be 0. That's the price to pay when we're dealing with a non-affine parameterization. But in here, I can replace those k bars by k's by dividing my mu. So the final outcome here is going to be 1 over mu times the k derivative of mu multiplying k alpha. So when I replace my k bars by k's, I get 2 factors of 1 over mu. So that becomes this. And then what this says is that I'm differentiating mu in the direction of k dividing by 1 over mu. And what we're getting here is the more general version of the geodesic equation with a non-zero right-hand side, but a right-hand side that's proportional to the vector itself. And the sort of acceleration parameter here that we're getting is, by definition, 1 over mu times the k derivative of mu. All right. So that's the statement that, of course, the new vector still satisfies the geodesic equation, but now it does so in a more general form. All right. Okay. So that's just a little bit of a sidebar. The real thing that I wanted to do is to calculate the expansion of those light rays. And again, I'm going to do the calculation for k, relying on what we know about k bar in order to finish this off. So just as an example, it might be worth calculating this. So kappa is 1 over mu, but we know what mu is, right? It's half f. So we get 2 over f. That multiplies the derivative of mu in the direction of k. But mu is a function of r. So we're working in Schwarzschild spacetime, where f is 1 minus 2m over r. So it only depends on r. So that derivative here will only pick out the r component of my k vector. And the r component of my k vector is half f. So we get 2 over f that multiplies half f. And then we get the r derivative of mu, which is also half f. So that's the outcome of the calculation. And then, of course, this cancels that. And f is 1 minus m over r. So we're going to get m over r squared when we calculate the derivative. So kappa for the Schwarzschild spacetime is simply 2m over r squared. So, you know, perfectly fine, perfectly harmless quantity that we can calculate. OK, so that's, again, a little sidebar. Right, so now I want to calculate the expansion. So originally, when we were talking about all of this, the expansion scalar for the rate of expansion scalar for null rays was given in terms of the divergence of the null vector. But all that was in the context of affine parameterization. That's how we formulated it in the first place. So under the old parameterization, we were dealing with an affinely parameterized null vector, and therefore we had a rate of expansion that referred to that affine parameter. That was defined to be, and I'll write it like this, the fractional rate of change of the cross-sectional areas of our light cones. And that was something we could calculate by just calculating the divergence of our null vector field. Yep?
Yeah, Yeah, so this kappa is surface gravity, right?
It's not yet.
But I'm just wondering, yeah, I get confused because I went out with a physical meaning, but if I just like choose a different parameterization, I'll get a different thing, right?
Yep. So it's not the surface gravity.
The surface gravity will be invariant, yeah?
So the surface gravity, So it will become the surface gravity when we look specifically at the generators of the event horizon. And but you're certainly right to think that there's a assumed choice of parameterization of those generators that's going to be given to us by the killing time. The killing time. So because the event horizon is going to be a killing horizon with a killing vector as an all generate as a tangent vector. That's going to fix the parameterization for us. And yeah, the surface gravity will be this evaluated on the event horizon. So we'll come to that. But it's not yet that, because here I'm looking at light rays that are outside, inside, and on the event horizon itself. OK. Yep. Which factor of no, there's no factor of two. You're right. Thank you. That was that. OK, so in the context of the affine parameterization, then all we had to do is to calculate the divergence of our vector field. But now in the new parameterization, what we're going to have is a slightly, different rate of expansion, because now rate will refer to the new parameter, namely V instead of R. So that is going to be the fractional rate of the change in cross-sectional area, but now rate will refer to, per unit V as opposed to per unit R, or changes in V, instead of changes in R. And this is something we would like to relate to a calculation we can make in terms of in terms of the new k vector instead of the old k hat vector. So we just want to adapt the definition of the expansion parameter or the rate of expansion parameter in terms of the new parameterization, something that we did talk about last time, but I just wanted to go over that fresh in case you don't remember, which probably, I don't, so why would you? All right. So what do we have here? Well, all we have to do really is to convert the derivative, right? So this is going to be the same thing as dr dv multiplying the old one. So we just do the conversion like this. And then we can work this out. dr dv, well, that's the same thing as mu. So let's reintroduce that notation. And then the divergence of, and then this theta here is the divergence of the old vector, but I'm going to just rewrite it as mu minus 1 times k. So I'm just converting like this, changing the parameter and changing, k bar into a k by rescaling everything appropriately. And then, then we can do the calculation. So the first term, of course, is going to be the divergence of k. So we still get that. But now we have an additional term, which comes from the derivative here. And that will give me a minus 1, mu to the minus 2. And then we're going to be dealing with the derivative of mu along k. And I had a name for this. That's what I called kappa before. So that was the purpose of this little sidebar over here, to establish that the kappa parameter that lives here is precisely that thing that lives over there. So what do we get from all of this is that, well, the expansion I'm looking for is actually the divergence of my rescale version of the k vector minus kappa. And now, we have an easy calculation in front of us. All we have to do is to calculate the divergence of k. We have already calculated kappa. And then we put the two things together. And that's going to be our answer, and then we'll be able to see what happens to those light rays as they, you know, travel inside or outside the black hole. So are we good for that here? Okay, so let's finish the job. I have to kill some of that stuff. No, let's leave this alone. Okay, just go here. So calculate divergence of K. I could skip the calculations here, but you know, it's really simple. I can rewrite the covariant divergence in terms of partial derivatives using the trick involving the metric determinant. And then we have that. And the metric goes over here, so we could calculate the metric determinant easily. And the metric determinant turns out to be r squared sine theta under the square root. So all the stuff involving f goes away when we calculate the determinant, and we get something simple like this. And then what do we have? Well, the sine theta here and the sine theta there will cancel out, because when I take derivatives here, there will be no derivatives surviving along theta. The only thing that will matter here is a v derivative with the v component of the vector and the r derivative and the r component. The v derivative will never give us anything because the spacetime doesn't depend on v, so it's a static spacetime. There's nothing depending on v explicitly. So the only thing that survives here is the r derivative. So we get 1 over r squared, r derivative of r squared, r component of k. And what's the r component of k? The r component of k is 1/2 f. So, well, that we can work out. We get 1 over 2 r squared. We get the r derivative of r squared minus 2m times r. And that gives us 1 over 2 r squared, 2 r minus 2 m. And if I expand it out, we're going to get 1 over r. And there's something funny happening here. Minus m over r squared. No, I think that's right. That's right. All right, so that's the divergence of K. So now we're going to combine it with the kappa calculation we just did. And we're going to see that the rate of expansion is equal to what we just computed, minus 1 over r minus, now we've got minus m over r squared here, and we've got another one coming from the minus kappa. So we get minus 2m over r squared. So what do we get from all of this? Finally, we get something that depends on r minus 2m, proportional to r minus 2m, divided by r squared. And sure enough, that changes sign on the event horizon. So not that we're very surprised, but that's something that just confirms the cartoon picture that we had before. The thing that we could draw directly from the Kruskal diagram. So just to go back to that, we go back to the Kruskal diagram. So we were talking about those light rays that, if they're outside, they're expanding. So we were talking about R increasing. And of course, that translates into theta positive. But if we're on the inside, we were talking about r decreasing, and that means that the light rays are converging. So this is r decreasing and translates into a theta that's negative. So expanding light rays, converging light rays, and sure enough, over here at r equals 2m, we have stationary light rays in the sense that their expansion is, so r constant, and we have an expansion that transitions smoothly from positive to negative by going to zero. So what's the property of an event horizon? Well, you know, if we assume static conditions for all times, then an event horizon will also be the boundary of the trapped region. And the boundary of the trapped region is the place where outgoing light rays have a vanishing expansion. Inside, we have trapped surfaces. Theta is negative. Outside, the surfaces are not trapped. And right here at the marginal point, we have, you know, what's called a marginally trapped surface, namely outgoing light rays with a zero expansion parameter, and that means that the light rays, even though they're, you know, escaping the black hole with the speed of light, they're staying still in spatial position regardless, and you know, that's a characterization of the event horizon when we don't have extra matter falling in that would spoil the staticity assumption that we made. And therefore, we don't have here the ability to distinguish between a boundary of trapped a boundary of trapped regions versus an event horizon. I think I'm making things more complicated than they are. So all I'm saying here is that because we're dealing with Schwarzschild spacetime, and because the Schwarzschild spacetime is assumed to be static at all times, we don't have the possibility of sending in matter at later stages. And it's under those circumstances that we can distinguish between the boundary of trapped surfaces, or the boundary of the trapped region, and the true event horizon. If we don't have the ability to do that, then the boundary of the trapped region and the event horizon will coincide. And it's exactly what we find here by identifying r equals 2m as the place where theta goes to zero. We are identifying the event horizon as the boundary of the trapped region. And that is something that had to happen for Schwarzschild, would not happen for a more general situation like this. So I think that's a good place to stop, even though we're a bit early, because I think to set up the next part of the discussion would take a little time. But let me announce what we're going to do in the afternoon. In the afternoon, I want to look at that situation. So, you know, as long as we keep the black hole static, things are pretty boring, and we, you know, don't have the ability of distinguishing between event horizon and the boundary of trapped regions. So is there a way of mathematically doing this in the presence of infalling matter? And the answer, of course, is yes, but that requires a more, you know, complete spacetime or a more complicated spacetime where we account for the infalling matter. That can be a very complicated thing to do, but there are very simple ways of doing it. And those very simple ways of doing it are extremely illustrative of the general case. So it's worthwhile to spend a little bit of time working on this. And we're going to do that in the early part of the lecture this afternoon. And it's also going to be the basis for one of the assignment problems that you have to work through. So I think that's going to be pretty pretty important. OK, so let's stop here. Any questions before we break?